And good morning. You're listening to People Rise Up on your non-commercial community radio station, KBOO. My name is Andrew Geller, and I have got a show chock full of news here for you this week. I like to throw one of these in every once in a while for folks who are maybe new to listening to the program. It's not only interviews. Okay, but we are going to follow up on material that has been the subject of previous interviews, including last week. Why don't we just start there? Okay, so last week I did a program about the melting cryosphere and speaking specifically about the northern part of it, that being the Arctic and Siberia. Sergei Kirpotin is a botanist at Tomsk State University, and he's been doing research in the peat bogs of the Western Siberian subarctic. And I was unable to get in touch with him last week to talk about some research reported on briefly about a week and a half ago regarding melting permafrost in Siberia. He and I have been in email communication, and I just wanted to share a little bit of his email because he is very concerned about inaccuracies being attributed to his research. So I just want to make sure that folks are clear on some things he is willing to say and some things he is not willing to say. I'm going to be paraphrasing and I'll reference quotes where appropriate. And to begin, he writes, quote, "To avoid any further speculations about this subject, I will send you my original paper about landslide thermokarst in the West Siberian subarctic." I actually have just a small bit of that here with me at the moment, haven't gotten through the entire thing yet. So he specifically wants people to be aware that the phenomena he describes regarding the Western Siberian permafrost has to do only in West Siberia peatlands in the subarctic zone. This is not something that can be attributed completely across the vast expanse of Siberia, although that doesn't mean it's not happening. It's just where he has been doing his research. Additionally, regarding a topic that I'm very curious about and many others are, is the issue of methane release in those peat bogs, and he has no expertise on the issue of methane emission. Okay, I guess I'm going to go sort of in reverse order on the climate theme, and there it is. Okay, so last week there was a international climate conference in Greenland, and as part of that, scientist named Robert Correll. Robert Correll was in charge of the Arctic Climate Impact Assessment, which was a 1,400-page report written by more than 250 scientists and published last November regarding warming in the Arctic. He did an overflight with 22 environment ministers and other officials from around the world over the Ilulissat Glacier in Greenland. The Ilulissat Glacier is a United Nations heritage site, and it has shrunk by over 10K, or about 6.5 miles, in just the past few years. Robert Correll calls the shrinkage of the Ilulissat Glacier, quote, "one of the most striking examples of climate change in the Arctic. The lower extremity of the glacier, quote, has receded by more than 10 kilometers in 2 or 3 years after having been relatively stable since the 1960s. In fact, the glacier shrank by 4.3 miles between 2002 and 2003 12-month cycle. The glacier is calving, which is a scientific term for releasing, huge ice rocks and is moving 35 meters or approximately 100 feet per day and discharging icebergs into the sea. That rate of retreat is equivalent to 2.5 feet during the course of this 30-minute program, 5 feet an hour, the Ilulissat Glacier is retreating. Jason Box, who is also at the conference, he's a professor with the Byrd Polar Research Center at Ohio State University, and he recently led a research project on the glacier financed by the U.S. space agency NASA. His team measured the depth of the ice caps lakes and found that water production had increased 30% in just 17 years. Jason Box said, quote, "more water is moving through the Greenland ice sheet system, and there appears to be a link between more abundant meltwater and the observed increase in ice flow acceleration. The volume of the water in the inland ice is very important because it affects the speed with which icebergs travel to the sea and thus impacting the water level of the world's oceans." and that relates to the short article I read or referenced last week about salt water and fresh water having different volumes, whether in the ice state or the liquid state. The August 17th link of articles on the People Rise Up website at kboo.fm has a link to that exact study. Moving from the impacts of climate change to one of its major causes, let's look a little bit at what's going on in the world of oil. So let's see. Why don't we do the great big one first? Oh, actually, no. Let's do a little bit of smaller news here. So yesterday, Venezuela's largest oil company, Petróleos de Venezuela S.A., South America's largest oil company, said it's going to increase its exports to China fivefold by 2012 as Venezuela seeks to lessen its dependence on the U.S. market. I wonder why the U.S. government wants to get rid of the president of Venezuela. Oh, and for those of you who missed it, evangelist and Christian terrorist Pat Robertson called for the assassination of Venezuela's president the other day. The Venezuelan vice president said it would truly be a test of the U.S. commitment to the war on terrorism in how it responds to Christian evangelist Pat Robertson's desire and expressed opinion that Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez should be assassinated. So we'll wait and see. Seems like there's a little bit of, let's say, double standard as to whether or not the terrorists involved happen to be Christian or of some other religion or other political persuasion besides that predominant in the Bush junta. So currently the U.S. takes about 60% of Venezuela's daily export of about 2 million barrels of oil. China currently receives only about 12,000 barrels a day. They want to get that up to about 60 or 65,000 in the next 6-7 years. Venezuela plans to double its country's oil production capacity to 5 million barrels a day by 2012. So Venezuela is going to be kicking out a whole lot more oil. And that's not necessarily going to be coming here. And that's really important because, as Mike Rupert has pointed out many times in his talks, oil coming from South America takes vastly less time to get here than does oil from the Middle East or even further afield. Now, most of you probably drive cars most every day of the week, possibly for most of the trips you make. And you've probably noticed that it's gotten a whole lot more expensive in the course of the past year or so. And, you know, there's many possible explanations for this. And I came across a very interesting new one that I had not heard just the other day. This is from econbrowser.com. And the articles I'm referencing today also have links for them at the People Rise Up website. So this is called Sweet and Sour Crude: Differences Across Grades of Oil Can Tell Us a Lot About Why Oil Prices Have Become So High. Crude oil produced by different, and this is quoting, crude oil produced by different fields differs importantly in viscosity and sulfur content. Breaking from the text, more viscosity, thicker oil. Back to the text, the more viscous crudes are called heavier, and those with higher sulfur contents are called sour, as opposed to low sulfur sweet crudes. The heavier and more sour the crude, the more difficult and expensive it is to turn it into usable refined products. The price of oil you usually hear, such as $65 a barrel, is the price of a light sweet grade. One factor contributing to the dramatic increase in the price spread is a decrease in the supply of light sweet crude. Obviously, higher quality crude supplies get used up first, and the world is now increasingly reliant on lower quality oil. Every year in the past 5 years, the average API gravity, relates to the specific gravity, how heavy or viscous crude is, the average API gravity of non-OPEC oil production has decreased, which means crude is increasingly heavier. And the sulfur content has increased, meaning crude oil is increasingly more sour and not sweet. And here's kind of the crux of the biscuit in here. Vital Trivia, which is a British-based organization with a very interesting website. Vital Trivia has used data from OPEC's August oil market report to calculate that global production of light sweet crude has actually declined between 2000 and 2004, which they imply means that peak oil has already happened as far as the light, sweet, inexpensive oil is concerned. So check that again. There's different grades of oil. The best, least expensive stuff obviously goes first. And according to data analysis of OPEC information produced by Vital Trivia, peak oil has happened as far as light, sweet, crude oil goes. And as they note in the original article upon which the Econ browser piece is referenced, individual countries have peaked, for example, the U.S. in 1970, but as well as Norway and Venezuela and the United Kingdom and Indonesia. Venezuela, that may actually not be correct. He didn't know about them wanting to try and ramp up their production. But individual companies have peaked. Chevron, Exxon, Shell, and Total, the French company. British Petroleum may have just about peaked. They had a 3.5 increase in second quarter production, but it doesn't seem like they're going to be able to hold on to that, and annual production remains to be seen. And now these folks say that the first individual grade of oil has peaked, that being light sweet crude. If you want to read more about this from Vital Trivia, go to www.vitaltrivia.co.uk, and you could just, I guess, suppose search for an article that has OPEC in it, and you'll see it. It's from just like a day or two ago. Now, another issue related to the lack of enough light sweet crude in the oil market is that marginal refining capacity that is available in the world right now is not engineered to process heavy sour crude oil at all. Thus, extra refining capacity has no relevance based on the type of oil becoming more and more prominent in discovery and extraction, and there isn't enough light sweet crude oil to go around anymore, according to research from Vital Trivia. And they say that peak oil has happened as far as the cheap oil goes. We'll have to see what annual numbers look like. Again, this is only a phenomena that's visible in the rearview mirror of time, so we'll just have to see. Let's see, following up on something we referenced a few weeks back as the real reason why the Bush administration still talking about invading Iran based on allegations related to its nuclear enrichment process. However, yeah, and just last week he said he'd consider using force as a last resort to press Iran to give up its nuclear program. However, in an article I can't find, oh, here it is, Saturday. The United Nations Nuclear Agency tests have concluded that traces of highly enriched uranium on centrifuge parts were from imported equipment rather than from any enrichment activities by Iran. The findings support Iran's claim that the material entered the country with the centrifuge parts provided by Pakistan. It's interesting you don't hear a lot about Pakistan being a problem with its nuclear program. So the IAEA has said Iran has no enriched uranium at this point. And yes, the plant in Isfahan is underway, but at this point, there's no basis for a weapons of mass destruction claim as a reason to intervene in Iran, much like there never was one regarding Iraq. So along those lines, William Clark writes from August 5th of this year. This is reposted at Media Monitors, and there's a link at the People Rise Up website at kboo.fm. This is a very long article. It's called Petrodollar Warfare, Dollars, Euros, and the Upcoming Iranian Oil Bourse. This is going to be a large paraphrasing here. Okay. From the article, it is now obvious that the invasion of Iraq had less to do with any WMD program, certainly less to do with fighting international terrorism, than it had to do with gaining strategic control over the hydrocarbon reserves underneath Iraq's territory, so it can maintain the U.S. dollar as the monopoly currency in the international oil market. In 2003, the global community witnessed a combination of petrodollar warfare and oil depletion warfare. In 2002, I, being William Clark, wrote an online essay that asserted Saddam Hussein sealed his fate when he announced in September of 2000 that Iraq would no longer accept dollars for oil sold under the UN's Oil for Food program, deciding instead to switch to the euro as Iraq's oil export currency. This original hypothesis was validated in a Financial Times article dated June 5 of 03, which confirmed Iraqi oil sales returned to the international markets once again in dollars, not euros. So, 3 months after the U.S. invasion, Iraq was exporting oil in dollars again, not euros. I believe at the same time there was still, say, looting and ransacking of museums and ministries and such, but it's good to see they were able to get their priorities in focus and get the oil exports back to dollars. So back to the text. The Bush administration implemented this currency transition despite the adverse impact on profits from Iraq's oil export sales. Because in mid-2003, the euro was valued approximately 13% higher than the dollar. So, check that. The Bush administration was willing to sacrifice 13%, nothing to sneeze at, in terms of profits, so they could export oil with dollars and not euros. This detail has never been mentioned in the five U.S. major media conglomerates. Concerning Iran, recent articles have revealed active Pentagon planning for operations against its so-called suspected nuclear facilities. There are again unspoken macroeconomic drivers underlying this second stage of petrodollar warfare, Iran's upcoming oil bursts. In essence, Iran is about to commit a far greater, quote, offense, end quote, than Saddam Hussein's conversion to the euro for Iraq's oil exports, because in March 2006, the Tehran government plans to begin competing with New York's NYMEX and London's IPE with respect to international oil trade using a euro-based trading mechanism. Without some sort of U.S. intervention, the euro will establish a firm foothold in the international oil trade, and given U.S. debt levels and the stated project of U.S. global domination, Tehran's objective constitutes an obvious encroachment on dollar supremacy in the oil market. Deep within the Pentagon, planning regarding Syria and Iran have been, quote, busier than ever. In the December 2004 issue of the Atlantic Monthly, James Fallows spoke with Sam Gardner, a retired Air Force colonel who ran war games exercises at the National War College for 20 years. Colonel Gardner summarized the outcome of war games simulations regarding Iran, quote, "You have no military solution for the issues of Iran, and you have to make diplomacy work." Followed by an article in early 2005 by Seymour Hersh in The New Yorker, who was repeatedly told by high-level U.S. intelligence sources the next strategic target was Iran. And most recently, and possibly most troubling, according to William Clark in Media Monitors, an article in the New American Conservative by intelligence analyst Philip Giraldi, his article, "In Case of Emergency, Nuke Iran," yielded a shocking disclosure that in the event of another 9/11-type terrorist attack on U.S. soil, Dick Cheney's office wants the Pentagon to be prepared to launch a nuclear attack against Iran, regardless of whether or not Iran played a role in any attack. Now, it was like 3 or 4 hours after the attacks of 9/11 were completed that Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld and Paul Wolfowitz were discussing in a meeting attacking Iraq, as documented in Richard Clark's book, former White House counterterrorism official. And it seems a whole lot like the same thing might be gearing up regarding Iran. And Bush's poll numbers are the lowest they've ever been. Apparently, they're also the lowest of any second-term president in United States history. And let's face it, he sucks. Duh. No wonder his poll numbers are low. He is just unbelievably arrogant and has this perspective that nobody else has any valid information aside from his inner circle. So it's dangerous when the Bush administration has low poll numbers. We'll have to see. I guess I'll just jump in with a last piece here. This is from Knight Ritter last Friday. A new Taliban has reemerged in Afghanistan. I haven't marked this up, so I'm going to do this on the fly here. Just bear with me. So from the text, quote, nearly 4 years after a U.S.-led military intervention toppled them from power, the Taliban has reemerged as a potent threat to stability in Afghanistan. Today's Taliban is fighting a guerrilla war with new weapons, including portable anti-aircraft missiles and equipment bought with cash sent through Osama bin Laden's Al-Qaeda network, according to Afghan and Western officials. The money is coming from, quote, rogue elements and factional elements living in the Middle East, said Afghan Defense Minister Abdul Rahim Wardak. Al-Qaeda is channeling money and equipment, said Lieutenant George Hubanks, a U.S. Army intelligence officer in Zabul province, one of the worst hit by Taliban insurgency. The Taliban is linked together by a loose command structure with an aim of driving out U.S.-led coalition and NATO troops, toppling U.S.-backed President Hamid Karzai, and reimposing hardline Islamic rule on Afghanistan. I think I'll just leave that at there. And, for those of you who missed it, Iraq seems like they're going to be a theocratic state with not a whole lot in the way of equality for women. And, certainly not what the Bush administration said it was going to do by establishing a secular democracy in the Middle East. So go Bush administration for establishing a new Islamic theocracy in the Middle East. That's really great. Not necessarily that it's, I think people should be able to self-determine, but anyway. So, let's see, got a few minutes left here. We're going to run Making Contact today. And I want to let folks know a little bit about what's coming up in future weeks here on the program. KBOO's membership drive begins September 14th and runs through October 4. On September 14th, I will be speaking with Nafiz Mossadegh Ahmed, author of The War on Freedom. He has a new book out called The War on Truth, and it provides tremendous levels of detail about the historic and ongoing connections, financial, military, geostrategic, between the U.S. government, the British government, and the Al-Qaeda network. So stay tuned for that. And the article I just referenced regarding the Taliban in Afghanistan, I wouldn't be the least bit surprised if the United States was still providing assistance to the Taliban directly or indirectly through the Pakistani ISI. We'll talk a whole lot more about those things on Wednesday, September 14th. That show will begin at 9:30 and run till 11. The next week, September 21st, author Tariq Ali will be on the program talking about a book he put out in April called Speaking of Empire and Resistance. He was thrown out of Pakistan in the 1960s for speaking out against the military dictatorship there. And he's a prolific author, playwright, commentator, etc. Thrilled to be speaking with him. And then in what weekend would that be? I guess September 28th, the last show for Pledge Drive of People Rise Up, Vandana Shiva will join us to speak about a new book of hers called Earth Democracy, something we've talked about on the program before, but never in as much detail as we will then. The People Rise Up website is available online at kboo.fm/programs/4, and that's the number 4, .php. All the articles referenced today will have links to the originals there. Why don't I go to a quick piece of music here that I wanted to feature from Dave Rovics earlier on in the program, and we'll have that announcement and making contact real quick.
Were you drinking wine from Argentina or Indonesian coffee? Did you take some in a plane and go fly across the country? Did you go to work the next week, drive your daily 20 miles? Stop at Sears to see the latest Chinese styles. When you did these things, did you wonder how or why? In the years before the oil wells ran dry. Were you watching the news? Did you wonder when they'd bomb another country or start up the draft again as you tried to stop the war that might decide the planet's fate? Did you stop to question how that food got on your plate as you stuck your fork into that slice of pie in the years before the oil wells ran dry? When you went back to college to get another PhD, or you went into the studio to record one more CD, did it occur to you that your time might be spent better digging in the earth or learning to knit a sweater? Did you prepare for all the changes, or at least pretend to try, in the years before the oil wells ran dry? When the cars and planes stopped running and the dollar hit the floor and the hordes of hungry children were knocking on your door, when unemployment in the streets said blame the Arabs for our plight, did you shout with dirt held high, farmers of the world unite? Did you ride an ox into town, say join the green revolution or die, in the years before the oil wells ran dry?